HBA 19, 2006, currently research fellow in the Oxford University.
So, transformers theory is a three-dimensional topological field theory, which was introduced by Witten in the late 80s, and which depends on a choice of gauge group G, compact Lie group, and an integer called the level. It's described by the following well-known action functional, where here M3, the spacetime manifold M3, is often taken to be a closed manifold. The basic field A is a connection one form. So let me write up the action functional up there so that you have it. As a first step towards understanding Chern-Simons theory, let us compute the variation of the action. So I take epsilon to be a small modification of A, and then I expand to first order, get this formula. The two terms which I'm underlying right now are equal by Stokes' theorem. And as a result, this big thing can be rewritten in the following form. Now, the classical solutions are characterized by the fact that this expression down there is 0 for every choice of epsilon. And this can actually only happen if this term that I'm putting here in red, and which reappears here, is 0. And these are called the flat connections. The partition function is given by the usual path integral. And the Hilbert space of the theory is given as the geometric quantization of the moduli space of classical solutions. I mean, this is like a very general prescription in any quantum field theory. You take the classical solution. So this is a sigma refers to a two-dimensional manifold, the like Cauchy surface, and then take sigma cross R, which is now three-dimensional, which is the dimension of my theory, take classical solutions there. That thing, that moduli space, is a symplectic manifold. That's the symplectic form. And you can take geometric quantization, you get a Hilbert space. The thing to note here is that this moduli space is compact, assuming sigma has no boundary, is compact, and so the Hilbert space is finite dimensional. The dimension of the Hilbert space will depend on the topology of the manifold sigma, but it's always finite dimensional. Now, all these are very standard definitions if you've ever heard about Chern-Simons theory. The next question is, how does one compute these things? And conveniently, there's an equivalent theory, which is purely combinatorial. It's purely finite dimensional, which is called Rashid-Dakin-Turayev theory. And in order to define Rashid-Dakin-Turayev theory, there is a certain input which is needed, and that input is a certain category, which is the thing up there on the right, rep LG. So that's the category of representations of the loop group. So let me tell you a little bit about the loop group. The loop group, mathematically, that's just a set of maps from a circle into my group, into the group manifold. You can think of it as being the classical configuration space of a string moving on the group manifold G. And here by rep LG, I mean the collection of representations of LG at level K. Let me tell you what that level K means. This group G has the corresponding loop group LG. That loop group actually admits a central extension by U1. And really, this is a misnomer. We're talking about representations of LG tilde, or projective representations of LG. And the level K is just saying that this central U1 is required to act in a specific way. It's required to act by this character. Now to describe the central extension, which I'm writing there, it's easier to pass to the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra of LG is this thing in blue there in the middle. It's called the current algebra. And the central extension at the Lie algebra level is given by a very explicit formula, which I wrote for you here. So great, that's the loop group. Now let's suppose that I have a surface, sigma, and I want to compute the Hilbert space using the right-hand side, using Rachitic and Tuareg theory. So here's how the construction works. First, you pick a collection of circles that split your surface into so-called pairs of pants. A pair of pants is just another name for a sphere minus three disks. So here you have one, two, three, four pieces. Each one of them is a pair of pants. And the Hilbert space is then going to be expressed as a direct sum indexed over all possible labelings of these red circles by representations of the loop group, by irreducible representations of the loop group. Then you have a tensor product over the various pieces. In this case, it's going to be four pieces. And the thing that enters in the tensor product is the space of homomorphisms from, so here I have lambda, mu, nu. These are representations. Take the fusion of these two into that. So I should have said that once you commit to working at a particular level, there's only finitely many representations of LG at that given level. So this direct sum is a finite direct sum. Similarly, that's a finite tensor product. And those spaces, lambda, mu, and nu, LG is a big infinite dimensional group, and these are infinite dimensional things. But that term, which is here in red, is actually finite dimensional because I'm looking at homomorphisms of LG representations. And overall, you get a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Now, Sain said that you cared about the partition function. So you pick a three manifold. And there's a similarly explicit, similarly combinatorial way of just writing down the thing. I won't do it right now just because it's a bit messy. But I'm just telling you, it's an explicit thing. You can just like do it. It's a finite. Yes?
I'm sorry. Could you give me some equation for these loops? They were eventually Wilson loops, the elements of the loop group. Like, what are these lambda mu's?
These are representations of the loop group. There are certain Hilbert spaces, infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, with an action of the loop group. So you have this sort of, inside the definition of this finite dimensional thing, you have these infinite dimensional guys. So these are just representations of LG. Now, well, there's like, you can ask like, what are these Hilbert spaces? I mean, these are certain charged sectors of some associated conformal field theory. But I mean, this is sort of not what I'm talking about right now. Right now, I'm sort of trying to convince you that this is all finite dimensional, and there's just some inputs that are infinite dimensional, but that are hidden in there. Great. So I won't tell you what that is. But there is a natural question that begs to be asked. It's like, why on earth are these two things equal? I'm making a statement up there. Turn Simons, I told you what it is Rachitic and Tuareg. I told you a bit of what it is. These two things look nothing alike. So I'm not going to really justify that. I'm just going to tell you these are well-established facts. There's both at the level of the partition function and at the level of Hilbert spaces. So at the level of the partition function, really, you have to ask yourself what exactly is it that you could possibly check, because this is given by a path integral. And so what can you do? Well, what you can do is do a perturbative expansion of this thing to get some approximation. And you can try to compare that with the exact number given by that. And that comparison has been done. There's a paper by Dan Fried in the early 90s where he just checked it. And he shows that there's like perfect agreement within what you expect. At the level of the Hilbert spaces, there's a paper by Eve Laszlo, where again he checks that the Hilbert spaces are equal, and they're equal not just as vector spaces, they're equal in a much more structured sense, like they're equal as vector bundles over the marginalized space of surfaces. Like, it's like really well understood equivalence between these two theories. Great. So now there's one thing which is staring at you in the face on the side of Reshetnikin Toraev theory, and which is so far absent from the Chernus-Hammonds theory, is this category, rep LG. What is it? That's essentially your question up there. What is that category, and what is the physical meaning of the category? So that's called the, like, if I want to just like be precise, that's called the category of positive energy representations of the loop group at level k. And physically, these are the possible charges of Wilson lines in Chernus-Hammonds theory. Now, mathematically, that category is what Chernus-Hammonds theory assigns to a circle. Now, you might not be very familiar with this idea that Chernus-Hammonds theory assigns things to a circle, and what, like, what does it mean that the quantum field theory assigns things to a manifold, which has like this, in this case, it's a three-dimensional theory, and this is a one manifold. So there's this, this idea is called extended quantum field theory and has been around for quite some time, except that it was mostly mathematicians that were pursuing this formalism. And I think that I should tell you a bit more about how it works. So as I told you, if I have a three-dimensional manifold, this little three up there just means it's just an indication of what the dimension of the manifold is. You have a number which is associated to that, and you know what that is. That is a partition function of the theory on the manifold. I have a two-dimensional manifold. Before it was called sigma, now it's called M2. I have a vector space, and that's the Hilbert space of the theory. If I have a one-dimensional manifold, the axioms of extended quantum field theory say that I should assign to that something, and the kind of thing that I expect to assign is, then there's a bit of a choice. Like, either you can say you want to assign to it a category, or you can assign to it an algebra. And both are kind of okay things to do. And the reason why they're both okay is that if I have an algebra, I can transform it into a category. I can replace an algebra by its category of representations. And conversely, if I have a category which happens to be rep A for some algebra A, then I may as well have said that A was the value of the theory on the circle. So anyways, for us, it's going to be convenient to work with categories. And in the case of Chernus-Hammonds theory, the relevant category is representations of the loop group. Now, I mean, it sort of like becomes more and more abstract as you go down. If I have a zero-dimensional manifold, which is just a bunch of points, or possibly just one point, what you want is a two-category or possibly a tensor category. And the reason why you can choose between these two things is pretty much the same as the reason why you can choose between categories and algebras. Now, I won't be using two categories. And frankly speaking, I'm not really sure why it is that I'm mentioning them right now. Anyways, I will be using tensor categories throughout this talk. Maybe I should tell you what a tensor category is. A tensor category is a category equipped with a multiplication. Just like an algebra is a vector space equipped with an operation, equipped with multiplication, a tensor category is a category equipped with a way of taking two things in the category and multiplying them. Well, I will tell you shortly what it is that I propose to put here, like as the what Chernus-Hammonds theory assigns to a point. But first of all, I need to tell you a bit more about extended quantum field theory. So in extended quantum field theory, there's not just closed manifolds. There's also manifolds with boundary. And really, this is like the place where I wish I was giving a board talk to draw some nice pictures. So let me give myself a couple of boards. And so suppose I have a three-dimensional manifold that now has boundaries. So if the manifold was a closed manifold, I assign to that a number. Now I have a vector space here and a vector space there, and what I'm going to assign to that is a linear map from this Hilbert space to that Hilbert space. And suppose I have a closed manifold, a closed three-dimensional manifold, and I take it and I chop it into a bunch of, like here, like these vertical lines indicate the place where I chop it. I take like my, have a loaf of bread, I take a knife and like tuck, tuck, tuck. And then you have these various pieces. Each one of these pieces has an associated linear map, and you can compose these maps. So let's think about it. So we have here a Hilbert space, here a Hilbert space, here a Hilbert space, but you should also think that there's a Hilbert space there, which is like the trivial Hilbert space, the one-dimensional Hilbert space, just the complex numbers viewed as a Hilbert space. And same thing there. And so here I have a map from the complex numbers into this Hilbert space, also known just as a state in the Hilbert space, and then a linear map, and then a linear map, and then a state the other way. And you can form this expression, and that's going to be a number at the end. So that's a way of recovering the partition function as a composite of linear maps, because a linear map from C to C is just a number. And so that's the number that you recover. Now let's do everything again, one dimension down. If I have a two-dimensional cobordism between a one manifold here and a one manifold there, so recall that to a one manifold, we had decided to assign a category. And now a map from a category to another category that has a name in mathematics, that's called a functor. So we want a functor. And if I had decided to, instead of working with categories, to work with algebras, what I would be putting here is a bimodule. But I'm not doing that, so forget about it. And similarly, if I have a two manifold, which is cut into pieces, then what do we have? We have a functor, and then again a functor, and then again a functor, and then you can compose them, and you get a functor from the trivial category to the trivial category. So now this is becoming a bit abstract. A linear map from the trivial Hilbert space to the trivial Hilbert space that turned out to be the same thing as a number. And now I claim that a functor from the trivial category to the trivial category should be the same thing as a vector space. So what is the trivial category? The trivial category is the category of vector spaces. Let's call it vec. Vec is what I have here. And vec is what I have there. And I claim that a functor from vec to vec is the same thing as a vector space. Just kind of, anyways, it is what it is. So great. So now, as I told you, the thing that I want to assign to a circle, well, it's not me, it's like it's actually a well accepted thing that has been around for quite some time, that Schoen-Simons theory should assign to a circle the category a rep LG. So great. Oh, sorry, this is not what I wanted. Why is this important to do extended quantum field theory? The reason why this is important is because of a theorem called the cobordism hypothesis. This was proposed in the 90s by Baez and Dolan and was proven roughly 8 years ago by Jacob Lurie. And the cobordism hypothesis says that provided you could continue this game and go all the way down to points, that's called an extended, that's called sometimes a fully extended quantum field theory. I'll call it just extended quantum field theory in this talk. Provided a quantum field theory is of that extended kind, then what this quantum field theory assigns to a point remembers the whole thing. You can recover it in a canonical way from what it assigns to a point. And so what this means is that if I have, and this works only for topological quantum field theories, if I have a topological quantum field theory, which is very interesting, like Schoen-Simons theory, then what it assigns to a point is bound to be at least as interesting as the thing itself, because it contains all the information. Great. So now let's recall that what Schoen-Simons theory assigns to a circle is the representations of the loop group. So rep LG is what Schoen-Simons theory assigns to a circle. Now I can do a small modification of this loop group, which works as follows. That's called the base loop group. And it works as follows. I'm not going to look at all loops that are like free to float wherever they want in this manifold. I'm going to insist that they be attached to the element 1 in my group, so that they start and end at 1. And if you think of these loops as being like strings floating in the manifold, then these are a bit like open strings, where you treat this point like a D-brain. You say, I'm going to look at strings that are constrained to start and end on that zero-dimensional submanifold. Anyways, omega G, just like LG, is a topological group, and it makes sense to look at its category of representations. And so that is what I propose as the value of Chern-Simons theory on a point. That is what I propose as what Chern-Simons theory assigns to a point. Now, in order to explain why this is a reasonable proposal, and right now I'm just saying, like, this is a thing. Why is it a reasonable thing? Well, in order to do that, I need to tell you more about how extended quantum field theory works and how am I supposed to recover the whole TQFT from what it assigns to a point. Like, what is the procedure of like recovering everything from that single point? Okay, so up there is my proposal, and here's how it works. So now this is completely abstract. Z is going to be Chern-Simons theory, but it's like a three-dimensional extended TQFT, and let's say C to be what it assigns to a point. And C, I'm taking it to be a tensor category. Now you can ask, what does this TQFT assign to various manifolds? And you start from the smaller, like the point is like where you start, and then you sort of like start building up things that are not too far from a point, and they sort of go up in dimension. The very first thing that you encounter is just an interval, an open one-dimensional manifold. And this, you should assign to that. So you haven't really done anything by like taking this point and stretching it. So you shouldn't change anything. It should still be C, except that now I'm no longer supposed to assign tensor categories. I'm supposed to assign categories. And so what you do is you take C, and you forget that it was a tensor category, and you just view it as a category. And that's what you assign to that. But now you're like, wait a moment. This interval has two endpoints, and these are points. And how am I supposed to remember that fact? Well, you're supposed to remember C along with the left action and the right action that it has on itself. Anyway, so it's just a thing. Now, great. Let's do some other manifolds. Let's take the interval and bend it left and right to see what happens. Suppose I bend it to the left. Then nothing has really changed, so I'm not supposed to change anything. But what has changed is that these points are now on the left. So I'm supposed to have left actions as opposed to a left action and a right action. So how do you transform a left action into a right action? You say, I'm going to view it as a right action, like take the opposite thing. Opposite means that I redefine the product to be the like AB, I redefine it to be BA. And then what used to be a left action, a right action, becomes a left action, and I have that. So nothing really has changed. I can do it the other way around. And that, again, is just a sort of like mental gymnastics that nothing really changes. But now you can take the two things and put them together, and something is happening. So now I can take this and that and put them together. And what I'm supposed to do is this is a strange operation called tensor product of categories. And if I have a category and a category and a tensor category over with an action, and can make a new thing, and you get a beast called D of C, and that's called the Drinfeld center of the category. That's in the theory of quantum groups, there is something equivalent, which is called the quantum double. And anyways, it's a thing. And because what I told you here was completely formal, like no content whatsoever, it's just a general fact that if Z is an extended TQFT, then the value of Z on a circle is given by take the value on a point and apply this Drinfeld center. That's just a general fact. And then you can sort of like go on and build more, like do the higher dimensional things, and it becomes like increasingly obscure. But anyways, you get explicit formulas. So now I have a theorem, And this theorem I announced 2 years ago, but I ended up putting the proof on the archive only last month. And the theorem says that rep omega g, so the representation category of the base loop group, and rep lg are related to each other exactly by this operation. And so I want to convince you today that this theorem is good evidence that rep omega g is what Trans-Hammond's theory assigns to point. So here's how the argument goes. First of all, I told you it's generally accepted that the value of Trans-Hammond's theory on S1 is rep lg. So this statement has been around sort of kind of explicit for quite some time. So like papers by Dan Fried in the 90s where this is kind of there. But the one place where it's like really completely explicit and it appears like beautifully is a paper by Dan Fried and Konstantin Telemann from 2.5 years ago, where they start by the Lagrangian of Trans-Hammond's theory, and they do a completely explicit construction, which is a bit like geometric quantization, and except it's some form of categorified geometric quantization, and they apply it to the circle manifold, and they get out of it a category in the computed category, and it's rep lg. So it's like a very explicit direct connection between the action functional of Trans-Hammond's theory and this category. So this is something which is solid. That's something that has been around for some time. And now the general argument that I'm proposing is really only a consistency check. I'm saying that if we set it, the value of a point to be rep omega g, then we recover what we know, namely we recover the thing that appears in the first bullet point. And here's how it goes. So I take Trans-Hammond's theory of a point of S1, and by this general fact above, I can rewrite it as this Grünfeld center of Trans-Hammond's theory on a point. Now the assumption, which is right here on the line above, is that this is the same thing as rep omega g. So let me substitute rep omega g there. And at last, I have this thing here, which says that that is the same thing as rep lg. And so you can see this is the same thing as that. That's that statement there. And therefore, it sort of fits together nicely. It's consistent. And which is why I propose this thing. So now I realize that this was all very abstract, and I would like to try to give you some physical interpretation for all these notions that came here. So here we go. As I said, on a three manifold, what you have is the partition function. That's a number. On a two manifold, what you have is the quantum Hilbert space. That's a certain finite dimensional Hilbert space. On a one manifold, a circle, I told you what the answer is. It's rep lg. And I also told you that this is the set of possible charges of Wilson lines. In Trans-Hammond theory, that's a very well-known fact. And so the question is, this new thing that I'm introducing here, rep omega g, what is it? And I would like to propose that this is the same thing as line defects in chiral WCW. So I'm not completely convinced that this is exactly correct. This is a guess. Let me put a question mark there. What I do know for sure is that any line defect does produce a representation of omega g, but I'm not certain that this is a perfect correspondence. So one of these produces one of those, and one of these, well, maybe. I'm not sure. This is a guess. I should probably tell you what chiral WCW is. So Trans-Hammond's theory, well, up there, here's the action functional. And WCW is a certain boundary condition that you can impose. It's a conformal boundary condition. And the easiest way to describe it is as follows. Take the component of the A field, which is normal to the boundary, and call that A0. It's just a notation. And then this is just a condition. A0 restricted to the boundary vanishes.
Do you mean the Lamov component? That the Lamov component
is the component? So I've seen WSW derived this way. It's not exactly a thing that I'm not exactly confident about, like the like level of validity of the derivation starting from there. But this is definitely the most compact way which I found, which fits into this little ellipse. Like the actual thing that is maybe a better thing to say is to say that what you want to do is you want to impose that the connection restricted to the boundary is a flat connection, and then also at the same time restrict the gauge transformations to be gauge transformations that are locally that are just like locally constant along the boundary, which is.
When you say restricted flat connection, you mean a specific flat connection or just?
No, you impose the flatness condition on the boundary. Like when you write down the path integral.
But the condition should be Lagrangian the phase space, right? So the phase space was flat connection already. The parametric condition need a half dimensional thing in there, such as I fix the bundle.
Not exactly sure how to how to argue that. I mean, this is like, I mean, I have to confess that this is really not the way in which I work in practice with these things. I'm like, I'm not the kind of guy who starts with a Lagrange and actually does something. This, I'm sort of like just pretending to be one of them today, I mean, and like, as far as I'm concerned, like the path integral is just like something that isn't well defined, period. So whether this is a like less well defined thing to do than another one is like, well, I'm happy to. Anyways, I have seen a paper like there's a where like this is like the way this is presented. Yes, like so. Anyways, let's see. Where was I? So let me focus on these last two, and let me tell you about the various kinds of defects that I claim these correspond to. So we have bulk lines and boundary lines. If I have a three-dimensional space-time whose physics is governed by Chern-Simons theory, then you can have defect lines. There are topological defect lines. They can move them around. They don't affect any of the observables. And as I said, these are labeled by elements of rep LG. These are labels by representations of the free loop group. In the presence of a boundary, in this case a WZW boundary, you can still have bulk lines, but you can also have lines that are constrained to the boundary. The bulk lines are still labeled by rep LG, and these lines here, my claim is that they correspond to rep omega G, representations of the base loop group. Now, the result that makes me very optimistic about this proposal, that these lines should be labeled by rep omega G, is that the algebraic structure of these, the structure that's visible from the topology of these lines is exactly the same as the algebraic structure of these two categories. So rep LG and rep omega G, if you look at the algebra that you can do with these categories, it exactly mirrors the kind of picture that you can do with these lines. So let me be explicit about what kind of operations we have. If I have two bulk lines, you can do a braiding of these bulk lines. If I have two bulk lines, I can bring them together and fuse them to a new bulk line. If I have two boundary lines, you can fuse them together to a new boundary line. And at last, if I have a bulk line, it can sort of land and attach to the boundary line. And well, you can have some local operators here where I have these dots. So that structure is exactly the structure that I see in rep LG and rep omega G. And well, I should say that this is really only the first level of the structure. You really, then you have a lot of compatibility conditions between all these things. Like you can like take two of these and like braid and then fuse, or fuse and then braid, or like first bring to the right and then lands on there, or like all kinds of things. It's a rather rich structure. And this, so now what I'm telling you here is actually the same theorem that I had before, except written in a somewhat different way to make it a bit more digestible. The theorem about rep omega g is the Drinfeld center of rep LG is the Drinfeld center of rep omega g. What I'm telling you right now is the same result, except a bit in a more digested form. So all this structure, the braiding, the fusion, etc., which is present from the topology of these lines, is structure that is present at a purely mathematical level on these categories. And moreover, suppose you fix rep omega g as being the category of boundary lines. And you ask, what is the maximal category that I can put, which I can treat as being bulk lines? I mean, of course, you can sort of define it in a stupid way to say, I'm going to define that there's no bulk lines. I mean, you won't find any contradiction if you just define it like that, because you have nothing to make a contradiction with. But if I sort of like try to say, what is the maximal thing that I can put in the bulk, you recover exactly rep LG. And so this last bullet, in particular, says that you can reconstruct this from that. This is the maximal thing which is compatible with that. And reconstruct the bulk from the boundary.
Well, but you said before that the first is the Drinfeld center of the second, so that also reconstructs it, right? So.
That is the very same statement, yes. I'm not claiming that this is a different statement. I'm claiming that this is a same statement re-said in a different set of words so as to make it a bit more tangible.
Can I just ask a question? So the rep LG is supposed to be related to Wilson lines in the bulk?
Yes.
Do you think I can reconstruct the Wilson lines in the bulk from the defects lines in the boundary?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly right. So you can reconstruct the defect lines in the bulk from the defect, from the knowledge of all the defect lines that lie purely on the boundary. Now, suppose one accepts this claim that defect lines on the boundary correspond to representations of this base loop group. Then this has also consequences for full WCW theory. So full WCW theory is a two-dimensional conformal field theory, which the best way I like to think about it is that it's a sandwich of Chern-Simons theory between two chiral WCW theories. This one here is called chiral, and that one is called anti-chiral, just because you sort of look at it the other way around, but it's really just the same thing the other way around. So I guess another way of saying the same thing is that to say that this two-dimensional conformal field theory is a dimensional reduction of Chern-Simons theory along an interval, sort of like cross with an interval. And then you have to label the top and bottom part, like the bottom and top boundaries of the interval, by chiral WCW in order to get this full CFT, this full two-dimensional CFT. And by redrawing the top picture, so if you take the top picture and just, I mean, before we had the boundary and we had the line in the middle of the boundary, suppose I like sort of like squish it and redraw it. I mean, the thing in the middle is topological, so it doesn't care if it has been squished or if it's like stretched out. By redrawing it this way, you can reinterpret these line defects as boundary conditions for this full CFT. And so here we are, like rep omega g also has an interpretation in terms of boundary conditions for full WCW. So now the true test to know whether this whole translation exercise is any useful is, well, can I say something new about these boundary lines, or equivalently boundary conditions for full WCW model? Can I, in particular, classify them? Or can I propose a classification? And I have a conjecture, so I think that the answer is maybe yes. I don't have a theorem. But let me tell you the form of the conjecture. And the form of the conjecture is already something new, so that's something that is kind of potentially interesting. So the claim is that line defects in chiral WCW, equivalently boundary conditions for full WCW, are classified by the following algebraic stuff. And I mean, I won't get into the details of what this exactly means. So here we need a fusion category. A fusion category is like some kind of tensor category. An object in there and a central functor from rep LG into that fusion category. So that's like a braided tensor functor into the Drinfeld double of that. Okay, great. This looks like maybe it's a complicated thing, and indeed it is a complicated thing. I'm not claiming to be able to classify the things on the right, but this is a finite dimensional problem now. Like, you have reduced something which is intrinsically infinite dimensional to something which is finite dimensional. Still a very difficult problem, but it's finite dimensional. Maybe you can like explicitly produce examples of these things. Like, here's an example, here's an example, here's an example. I don't know how to get them all, but like, here's something. This statement comes with a couple of caveats. So let me.
There's no relationship between x and the functor.
No. First caveat is that actually there's way more line defects than can possibly be classified by that. So if I take a defect, one thing you can do is start fusing copies of this defect with itself and decompose the result into a direct sum of other defects. And most likely, if you do this, there's no guarantee that this process will stop. You'll keep getting new and new and new stuff. But sometimes this process, after a certain finite number of steps, will only produce defects that you've already seen. So maybe the fusion algebra closes after finitely many steps. And if that's the case, then it falls within the domain of applicability of this conjecture. And at last, second footnote is that if I have a line defect, let's call it D. If I have D, or suppose now I have an invertible defect, let me call it A. This invariant on the right will never be able to tell the difference between D and ADA inverse. Somehow you just don't see the difference. And so really, this is only up to conjugation by invertible defects. OK, it's a bit of a complicated statement, but it is a precisely formulated conjecture. Like, this is what I believe is the case.
The category of triples is, you think, is the same as the category of rep k omega g. Is that what you're saying?
Only those elements of rep omega g that generate a fusion category, and only up to conjugation by invertible things. Yes. So since you ask, let me be specific. There's two conjectures there, one in which I believe strongly and one in which I believe weakly. The one in which I believe strongly is that elements of rep omega g satisfying this modulo that are in bijective correspondence with this. This, I'm completely certain that's a true statement. I don't have a proof, but I think it's a true statement. Then there's a statement about line defects in chiral WCW being that. And that is something that I'm less certain that is a correct statement, because I'm not completely certain about the correspondence between rep omega g and line defects. As I said, a line defect produces an element of rep omega g, but I'm not sure that's a perfect correspondence. And really, one should ask exactly what kind of line defects one is looking at. Are we looking at topological line defects? Well, if one is looking at topological line defects, then maybe I'm not completely certain. Maybe we need to look at some kind of more rigid types of defects, but exactly what the actual physical things it is that I'm looking at is something that is, I'm just not completely sure. Great, so let me summarize what I have so far, because I'm reaching close to the end of my time. So the first point is that Chern-Simons theory appears to fall within this formalism of extended quantum field theory. This is something that was a long, I mean, since the very beginning, since the work of Dan Fried in the 90s, this was somehow around, like, how much can you push this formalism? It was known to be okay for Chern-Simons theory, whose gauge group is a finite group. So that's something that was around. The group is finite, yes, this does, this works. What if the group is a connected group, like SU2 or SUN? Like, well, this was, like, there were indications going in both directions. There were people doing condensed matter theory that were saying, no, this is impossible. If Chern-Simons theory was an extended quantum field theory, then this would mean that there exist gapped boundary conditions, and we know that's impossible, so this is impossible. And there's like a paper from maybe 5 years ago by Fried, Hopkins, Lurie, and Telemann, where they said that, but if the gauge group is abelian, then we have a proposal. And they don't know what to do when the gauge group is not abelian. So really, there were arguments in both directions. And so I claim that the answer is yes. And I also, somehow, because of the features of what rep omega g is, that doesn't contradict the statement about gap boundary conditions. I'm not claiming that there exist gap boundary conditions. Like, the argument was somehow assuming some properties, some finiteness properties, which is not satisfied by rep omega g. So I think this is important for Chern-Simons theory, but it's also important for the formalism of extended quantum field theory. Now, I'm saying this thing that maybe you have heard about or maybe not is an important way to think about quantum field theory. Maybe you want to also try to think about non-topological quantum field theories in this language. Like, I don't know, like, that might be interesting. Second point, what is the value of Chern-Simons theory in a point? Well, I claim that Chern-Simons theory assigns to a point rep omega g and physical interpretation as line defects in chiral WCW. As I said, this is a statement in which I believe strongly. This is a statement that I'm not completely confident in. At last, there's prospects of this being useful for saying something about these line defects, equivalently saying something about boundary conditions for full WCW theory. And I think I have reached the end of my talk. Thank you.
So, are there any questions? I believe starting from students.
So, if you take, say, just a representation of your gauge group, then you can, the way I would usually think about writing down the Wilson line, I could produce one just from that. From a representation just of the group, mm-hmm. and presumably the object in the your category of Wilson lines is constructed by just taking an induced representation, like the LG representation corresponding to this.
Yes, if I have a finite dimensional representation of G, not any one, ones belonging in a certain finite subset, then you can induce it up and like make it infinite dimensional, and now it's a representation of LG. That's a well-known construction of representations of LG.
So I didn't just want to tell you a fact.
Yeah.
But the thing I want to emphasize is I know how to write down a formula for this line defect in terms of this representation, and I can also see it as an object of your category. But is there an analogous thing you can do where you write down some example of a formula for a line defect in chiral WCW and then show how this thing is the same as also an object in your category of rep? I just want to understand more concretely why rep omega g what any single object in there might correspond explicitly to a line defect in comparable to W.
I think the best answer I can give you is how, given a line defect, you construct a representation of rep omega g. So let's not worry about how to construct line defect. Let's say, suppose I have a line defect, how do I interpret it as a representation of rep omega g, as a representation of omega g? So let's put the two constructions in parallel, the one for LG and the one for omega g. For LG, I take a disk, take my space slice to be a disk, and I put a defect in the middle, and then you say, well, associated to this picture, there should be a Hilbert space, and this Hilbert space should be infinite dimensional, and there should be, along the boundary, the loop group that acts. You have like the current algebra, which sort of is an algebra of operators that act on this infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Now, if I have a line defect, it's a thing that I can put here on the boundary. This is again a space slice of, so the space-time picture is a cylinder, which is filled, and I have a line defect along the boundary. Now I'm cutting this thing, and I just see a disk, which is filled with some Chern-Simons theory, and on the boundary I see this. Well, we're going to see the same current algebra acting everywhere around here, except here, where I don't really know what it is that is acting, so let's not put anything. Well, what is the group of things that are only supported here? Well, it's the base loop group. Operators that are supported only on a given interval is the set of loops that are trivial everywhere except here. Now I'm saying loops that are trivial at that point and allowed to do anything they want there. So that's the base loop group. So in that sense, that's a very natural thing to look at.
Is there interpretation? Suppose I have space, and I have a Wilson loop, a Wilson line in space, and I make a cut of the space. Then at the boundary, I'll get an endpoint where I cut the Wilson loop.
Yeah.
Is there some interpretation of your line defect in terms of some kind of cutting?
So when you cut, you have to. You can do two things that are kind of very similar in spirit but a bit confusing. One of the things that you can do when you cut is to say, I'm going to cut and I'm going to label this cut by the conformal boundary condition given by WCW. So that's one thing you can do. Or you can cut in this abstract extended TQFT manner where you sort of like have a three manifold and you cut here and here, and then at the end, you just imagine the corresponding thing being a linear map from this Hilbert space to that Hilbert space. And if you do that, then you never talk about WCW. So in both cases, it makes sense to have a Wilson line that reaches the boundary. If the boundary is colored by WCW, then what you have at the end of the Wilson line is an infinite dimensional Hilbert space of possible operators that you can put at the end, and those are going to be exactly elements of that LG representation. And if you put the kind of cut, which is the extended TQFT type of cut, then that's just modifying your Hilbert space. You have a different finite dimensional Hilbert space. So now that was the story for LG. Now let's do the story for omega G. For omega G, I need to already have a boundary, and I'm cutting a manifold with boundary. So in that formalism, when I have a manifold with boundary and I cut it, I don't really know what it means to cut it and then to label that new boundary again by the same WCW theory. Like then I would have a sort of weird corner with like WCW here and again WCW there. I'm somehow a bit confused about what that means. So I don't know how to do that. What I do know is to do the kind of cut like that you do when doing extended quantum field theory. And then what you have is a Hilbert space and an operator, but the Hilbert space now corresponds to a surface with boundary, and that's now an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And yeah, so formally it all works. Like, you can sort of like say what kind of object you like want to assign to this and what to that. I mean, but like really, you have to actually like come with like concrete examples of like how to compute this Hilbert space in order for it to have a particular meaning, which I'm not doing right now. But
so why couldn't you assign a Morita equivalent category to Morita equivalent to rep omega j?
Yes, you when you assign an algebra to a two-manifold or a tensor category to an algebra to a one-manifold or a tensor category to a zero-manifold, there's a freedom of changing the algebra to a Morita-equivalent algebra, equivalently one-dimensional noun, changing rep omega g to a Morita-equivalent tensor category. I don't know of any other tensor categories that are Morita-equivalent to rep omega g, and so the answer is yes, in principle. If you had another one which is Morita equivalent, I'd be equally happy for you to use that. But
basically,
I don't know.
There should only be one answer, right? Because this is a statement about surface defects in tensor necessarily.
Yes. So if I think the appropriate thing for me to do is to go to this slide and to say, if you work with this or with that, then the answer looks like it's not really one answer. It looks like it's many answers, like it's up to Morita equivalence. If you work with this or with that, then it's genuinely just one answer. So this is just a poor man's way to present a two-category. And the real thing is a two-category, except it kind of like hurts my nerves to like think about it, and then I think about tensor categories.
So what's the analog of taking the representations in this case?
Yeah, so if you have a tensor category C, you can look at the two category of all possible module categories over your tensor category. Just it's yeah.
What's the analogy between the Drinfeld center and functions on the free loop space?
There is
the formula sort of looks like the formula for functions on a free loop space. Right?
Yes, so there's a lot of mathematical results that have the same general flavor, that have on one side the based loops, on the other side the free loops, and in the middle something like the Drinfeld center. So these are unrelated results because they're not really about the same thing, but they sort of have the same flavor. So here's one of them. If I have the algebra of cochains on the base loop space of some manifold, and I want to recover, so this is like on your way towards computing cohomology of the manifold. The cohomology, you first compute, you first define the cochains, and then you get the cohomology. And you want to get the algebra of cochains on the unbased loop space of the thing. Well, there's a thing called Hochschild homology of that thing, and there's a theorem saying that these two things are the same. So this is like this is a, something very analogous to the Drinfeld centers, except in another world. So like Drinfeld center of base loops is free loops. This is just one instance. There's a thing called non-abelian Poincaré duality, which is a theorem by Jacob Lurie, which again has the same flavor. And so this is a recurrent theme that the free loops is just another name for unbased loops. The free loops should be recoverable from the based loops by some construction. And this is just saying that in the case of the representation category of these loop groups, the same kind of thing also reappears. It's a recurrent thing. It's also a bit similar to the way you recover the closed string sector from the category of open strings between all possible D-brains.
Are you sure you want omega there and not just cochains on M?
Did I get it wrong? I think I got it right, but I'm not sure.
Just two points mapped to M from which we pull back as three loops. Or, no, that's wrong, sorry. Two
that.
Copies of M mapped to M cross M from which we pull back as three loops.
Hmm. Maybe.
Because
I'm not sure.
M there.
Okay, possibly.
Looks like a model of OpenString and a model of closed. Any questions? Any more questions? Okay, let's take it again.